Dr. Oliver, as many of you know, especially our American friends, was one of the original founders of the John Birch Society, and for many years was a feature writer for American Opinion magazine. As a matter of fact, he was their ace reviewer, and many of us used to read those reviews very religiously. After World War II, I might say at the present time, Dr. Oliver is professor of classics at the University of Illinois. And after World War II, he was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship, and in 1953-54, studied in Europe on a Fulbright Research Fellowship. A scholar of international repute, Dr. Oliver is a member of no less than 14 learned societies. And today he's widely recognized as one of America's leading authorities on Latin America. During World War II, he was director of research in a secret agency of the United States War Department. And he's today one of America's outstanding authorities on international communism with respect to the race question. Some of you are familiar with his tremendous book, Conspiracy or Degeneracy. We have a supply up here at the front table. We were extremely fortunate to be able to induce Dr. Oliver to come up and participate in this seminar. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome Dr. Oliver and Mrs. Oliver, who is with the doctor on his visit, to welcome them to Toronto and to introduce Dr. Oliver to this audience. Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Gostick. Ladies and gentlemen, some years ago, a young corporation executive got married. And in the natural course of human events, the young couple had a son. While he was still a toddler, the boy saw a dog chase a cat. The next time the boy saw a cat, he dashed at it on hands and knees and gave a convincing imitation of a canine bark. His parents, naturally, thought that very, very cute. The little boy thereafter went through the performance whenever he was in a home in which there was a cat. Now, that was cute and funny for a time, but after a few years, it became rather embarrassing. And the lad either could not or would not heed parental pleas to desist. Whatever he saw a cat, whatever the time, the place, or the company, down he went on his knees and rushed at it, barking. Now, back in the horse and buggy days, that would have been no problem. But in our more enlightened age, the psychologists have taught us that children must not be punished or corrected. A zipping, that gives traumas into mind, no. So the parents took him to the local mind shrinker, who charged them $50 a visit for a year, and then referred them to a greater psychiatrist in Chicago, who charged them $100 a visit for 6 months, and then referred them to a yet greater witch doctor in New York, who charged them $200 a visit for 3 months, and finally, he recommended them to the very greatest man in the whole profession, the greatest psychiatrist in the whole world, Dr. Teufelsdröckh, a savant so illustrious that he lived on his estate in Westchester County, where only the elite could aspire to the privilege of being admitted to his presence. The boy's mother, however, found a hotel in the vicinity and took him to Dr. Teufelsdruck's mansion, where Dr. Teufelsdruck's nurse took charge of him and promised that the great man would see him soon. But no sooner had the mother returned to her hotel room than the telephone rang. It was Dr. Teufelsdruck's nurse, who said excitedly, "Oh, Mrs. Smith, please come and get your little boy right away." "What's the matter?" said the alarmed mother. "Is he ill?" "No," said the nurse, "but he is treed, Dr. Teufelsdruck. And oh, Mrs. Smith, please hurry. It just breaks my heart to see Dr. Teufelsdruck up in that tree and so piteously meowing for help." Mr. Gostick has asked me, ladies and gentlemen, to discuss with you the race war that is now underway in the United States. My function here certainly is not to deliver an oration weighted with rhetoric and emotional exhortation, nor is it to urge or recommend to you any course of action. You here in Canada have enough troubles of your own, and you are likely to have still more in the near future. I shall merely remind you that the white Occidental populations of Canada and the United States, although divided by government and to some slight extent by historical development and tradition, are peoples of the same origin, belonging to the same race, and sharing the same Christian civilization of the West, and that they have a common cause because they both belong to the world's most hated and despised minority. That, far more than our geographical contiguity, means that we have a common destiny. Although our enemies, adapting their methods to the differences in the composition of our populations and the structure of our economy, are attacking us in ways that superficially differ, the fact that you and we are of the same race means that you and we shall inevitably, in the long run, have a common fate, whatever that may be. As I see it, therefore, my function today is to give you, as objectively and dispassionately as I can, an estimate of the present plight of the United States with particular reference to the race war. Now, it would profit us little to recite either general statistics or typical details concerning the riots and small-scale insurrections that our federal government has incited and financed in more than 200 of our cities during the past 4 years. It would do little good to estimate how many hundreds of millions of dollars worth of property the savages have destroyed, how many policemen they have killed, crippled, or wounded, how many white women they have raped or mutilated or murdered, and how many other crimes they have committed with the encouragement and under the protection of our federal government and the more brazenly corrupt of our local governments. An account of some specific and particularly noteworthy atrocities might be shocking and thrilling, unless they've already come to seem commonplace, but it would not be very profitable for us to review them here, for the savages have committed no crime that a reasonable man could not have predicted and anticipated 10 years ago, or 50 years ago, or 100 years ago, merely on the basis of his knowledge of the nature and character of their race, and of their behavior, both in their native habitat, and in places such as Hispaniola, where they had already been incited to hatred of the white man, and of the civilization that the white man created. Harrowing and gruesome as so many of the atrocities are, they are really no more significant than what happens when you drop a lighted match into a barrel of gasoline. Everybody, except perhaps the feeble-minded, knows precisely what happens when you drop the match in the gasoline. And also everybody, unless extremely ignorant, should know precisely what congoids do when they revert to the savagery that is their natural state, and from which they can emerge only so long as they are under the tutelage and discipline of a civilized race. I need not describe the riots and insurrections that have taken place from 1964 to the present, and that are still occurring this summer. occurring despite the energetic and almost desperate efforts of the administration in Washington to postpone really sensational uprisings until after the elections in November. And that, in practical terms, means until next summer. For it is also characteristic of the Congoids that even their most enthusiastic apostles of social justice and civil rights don't like to bird and kill in bad weather, no matter how well they're paid for it. Here in Canada, you have undoubtedly learned something about the riots from your own press. You see, it is not feasible for the press entirely to suppress such news. Canadians do visit the United States, and most of them, I'm sure, are not sufficiently progressive to enjoy the sights that they might chance to see in Detroit, or Cleveland, or Newark, or Los Angeles, or Peoria, or almost any city in the northern part of the United States. Moreover, some of you have undoubtedly friends or relatives in those cities. And so long as you are permitted to use the mails and the telephone, it would be absurd to pretend that all is serene and lovely south of the border. The best that your press can do, therefore, is to minimize the outbreaks that are so noteworthy that some mention of them must be made, and either not report crimes or disguise them by concealing the race of the criminals, and then fill up the rest of their column with the usual hogwash about ghettos and the underprivileged, and suggest that the whole responsibility and guilt falls on the wicked white Americans who were so bigoted and selfish that they neglect their Christian duty to supply the noble blacks with enough Cadillacs, white whores, narcotics, incendiary bombs, and automatic rifles to keep them amused and happy. But if you have learned the art of reading lie papers and extrapolating from what they do report, you probably have a fairly good idea of what happens during the riots in this opening phase of the race war. In this first phase, according to the strategic plan drawn up long ago, the tactical objective is to terrorize and either kill, cow, or convert the very large part of our Negro population who would prefer to retain their carefree comforts rather than kill and loot. They are chiefly the older people who grew up when we still maintained a minimum of civilized order. Now, such conversions naturally increase geometrically, not only through terrorism and contagion of mass violence, but also as the domesticated Negroes reluctantly learn to despise us for our craven refusal to maintain order and protect ourselves and them. And as they behold with contempt the antics of white degenerates, especially the young punks and sluts that we hatch in our colleges and let loose on our streets to display their irrationality, their personal filth, and their conscious degradation that is so great that they mix, sexually and otherwise, with the blacks. But even with the intimidation and conversion of the peaceful Negroes, proceeding by a geometrical ratio, it will take another year at least to complete the first phase of the offensive against us. It will take another year, even under favorable conditions. And those favorable conditions include successful legislation to require first the registration and then the confiscation of firearms now in private possession of white men. That is necessary, you see, to reduce the occupational hazards which now deter even the best paid apostles of racial equality from invading white communities and enjoying a general butchery. Therefore, despite the impatience of our more liberal and progressive elements, you cannot expect before next summer at the earliest even small-scale massacres of whites, as distinct, of course, from rioting in the integrated areas, and as distinct from the beating and killing of stupid individuals who rashly venture into the streets of our cities after dark, alone and unarmed. I said next summer at the earliest, even under favorable conditions. Favorable, of course, from the standpoint of the persons who have planned and are executing this whole operation. The really interesting question, therefore, is how likely are those favorable conditions to be realized, and how soon? It seems to me, therefore, the most useful thing that I can do in the allotted time here is to consider with you what developments can reasonably be foreseen on the basis of present facts and human experience. I can indulge in no predictions or prophecies. I have no crystal ball to show me scenes of the future. I am unfortunately unaware of what the stars portend in their configurations and conjunctions. And unlike so many of my conservative compatriots, I have not been informed of any future miracle. All that I can do is reason from the present situation to what consequences are most likely. And I need not remind you that that necessarily means a calculation of probabilities, not a revelation of certainties. Let me begin, therefore, with the central fact now before us. The United States has passed the point of no return. It passed that point late in 1965, or at the very latest, early in 1966. The United States has passed the point of no return and now has no alternative. It can only go on to a grim and dire future of bloodshed, destruction, and widespread suffering. That is a fact, not a prediction, except in the sense that a statement made 5 minutes after the Titanic rammed the iceberg that the ship was going to sink could be called a prediction. As in the case of the Titanic, the only uncertainties now are how many lives will be lost and who will be their survivors. That is all. In the United States, I say, bloodshed, destruction, and human suffering on a scale surpassing anything thus far experienced are inevitable. I mean inevitable in terms of the calculations that can be made. One can, to be sure, imagine ways in which that future could be averted. A little race of green men from a more advanced civilization on Mars or one of the planets of Alpha Centauri may descend in flying saucers and put everything to rights for us. Or alternatively, Gabriel may appear this evening or tomorrow evening and blow his great trumpet. Blow it so loudly that the thunderous sound rolling through the heavens will be heard even by the many who will at that hour be staring at their boob tubes. Or there could occur the even greater miracle imagined by Quevedo in his Hora de Todos, a reversal of nature so great that politicians begin to tell the truth and our allied enemies fall out among themselves. But such blissful events are, I think, unlikely, and in any case, they certainly cannot be predicted by human reason. One can, of course, sympathize with those who irrationally insist on believing in miracles. Not long ago, an acquaintance of mine, who is becoming recognized as an authority on financial and economic matters, was discussing with a fairly prosperous couple ways of preserving some of their property in the days that lie ahead. After a few minutes, however, the lady suddenly stood up and cried, "But I don't want to know what is really happening." And she rushed from the room. Perhaps she had a point. As matters turned out, the citizens of Babylon, who feasted and caroused at their opulent banquet tables in drunken unconcern while the Persian army of Cyrus the Great was already within their walls, lived a little longer than they otherwise would have done, and suffered less pain when the sudden and unforeseen end came upon them. Perhaps that will also be true of those who obstinately today close their eyes and live in a world of dreams. But I am not a pessimist, though I do not believe that that is necessarily true. In this situation, where death and suffering are inevitably before us, the optimist hopes and even believes that we still have a chance to limit the number of deaths and the amount of suffering, and that what is more important, we can survive our disaster, and our posterity may recover what we have lost. The pessimist is one who is convinced that all is now irretrievably lost, that we shall perish, and that we shall have either no posterity at all, or descendants such that we would say of them that it would be far better had they never been born. I am still an optimist, you see, for if I were not, I certainly should not spend my time discussing distressing matters with you. There are 8 distinct factors in our present position that place us beyond the point of no return. For when the international lords set out to subjugate the American people, using Franklin Roosevelt as their first full agent, they planned to break the backs of the American people at every vertebra. In every way, from sabotage of our currency to sabotage of our armed forces, both in armaments and in morale. And their consistent and unremitting work for the past 40 years has been successful. But I here confine myself to the race war that they have so patiently contrived, for that alone will suffice to show why we are beyond the point of no return. And it is, I think, moreover, the crucial factor, for it is the one factor that is almost completely beyond their control now. Economically, for example, they undoubtedly have the power to either increase or to moderate the pressures upon us. Militarily, they can either increase or decrease the likelihood of an immediate military attack upon us. But the race factor is one that they almost have no control over now. Over the past 2/3 of a century, they have spent vast sums privately and far vaster sums from the public treasury to arouse and incite among the Negroes the violent and implacable hatred of white men that now animates the dominant segment of that race in the United States. Our enemies have done their work well, perhaps too well. What was a little cub when they began to nurture and train it in 1910 has become a raging grizzly that it is ever more difficult to hold in leash. The frenzied leaders of the savages are no longer content to have the public schools supply white children to be spat on, mauled, and sexually abused. Nor are they content in the large cities merely to rob, slug, rape, and murder after dark. They are no longer content merely to loot and burn while the police are under stringent orders not to interfere with the little darlings, and the militia, when they are called out after a maximum of procrastination, are given only blank cartridges, lest they discourage Washington's little pets. They are even finding it tedious to shoot policemen from ambush. 2 of the most raucous animals, one named Williams and the other called Carmichael, on the 14th and the 23rd of July, respectively, announced their determination to take for the blacks as much of the United States as has a climate that pleases them, and there to set up a black republic, from which, of course, the stupid white American rabbits that are not butchered when the territory is taken will be driven into the northern regions and there allowed to work to support their black masters in the luxury to which all blacks are entitled by birth. All that, of course, is merely a part of the original plan formulated in detail in 1922, the plan for to carve a black Soviet from the territory of the United States. It was openly proclaimed even before 1922, but since that date, the date of the famous raid in Bridgman, Michigan, everybody knew or should have known about it. We may therefore assume that the plan to set up a black Soviet on the territory of the United States is now known to and heartily approved by all the renegade Americans that you see and hear yammering for more civil rights and yowling about the evils of racism. The less thus excited cannot be appeased, for every appeasement merely incites them, inflames them. And those lusts cannot now be repressed without a fearful violence, without the sternest imposition of martial law and a virtual dictatorship. Mobs, it is true, can be dispersed or subdued by troops. But the guerrilla warfare, for which the blacks have been thoroughly prepared and equipped, cannot under any circumstances be controlled easily or without heavy losses to the white population. Nothing now can change or control the passions of the exhilarated savages who have learned to hate and despise the white man. To hate him for the most cogent of reasons, because he is white and because he is unapproachably superior in all things that comport with the civilization that he created. And to despise him because he is so stupid that he actually permitted them to vote. So stupid that he permitted them to be told that they are his equals. And so stupid that he now permits them to act as his masters. The hatred now aroused cannot be sated by anything short of the total enslavement of white men and the eventual disappearance of their race in a mass of fetid, brutish, and degraded mongrels who will, after the last white is gone, be equally hated by the blacks. For you must remember that in Haiti, after the savages, with the help of Great Britain, broke loose and butchered all the whites, they then turned their hand to the more leisurely task of exterminating the mulattoes. Now we may be certain that the United States will not become a huge Haiti. Its territory is too valuable and it is coveted. If the Americans continue to submit to the world government that had now effectively rules us in all but name and a few formalities, then certainly after the savages have done the work for which they have been trained, and after the Occidental population of the United States has been mongrelized, defiled, and beaten down to the level of cringing and mindless animals, fit only to work for their masters with the resignation of horses and oxen, then world government will surely dispose of the savages, for which it will have no further use. That's what one should expect. Many years ago, I read about a murder ingeniously committed in the early years of this century. A man decided to kill his business partner. So he bought a good dog, trained it to bite on command, and invited his partner for dinner. Just before the partner arrived, he coated the dog's teeth with a serum containing the infection of rabies. And when the partner entered the house, the dog on command bit him. Then the murderer shot his dog. We may be sure that world government will shoot its dog after the dog has served his purpose. But that will not do us any good. We will be dead, or at least wish we were. The other possibility, of course, is that white Americans will at long last try to defend themselves and even to recover their independence. That will cost them blood and tears, much blood and many tears. But in the past, certainly, our race was willing to fight for survival, and it may therefore again prefer to fight rather than to submit to ignominious slavery and whimpering extinction. Our problem then is to calculate the probability that the Occidentals and the United States will try to resist while they still have a chance of success, and the probability that their resistance will be effective and ultimately successful. That is our problem. I regret that I do not know the answer. I cannot measure the latent forces that may still be present in the minds and souls of Americans. And without measurement of all the vectors, I cannot compute either the direction or the velocity of the resulting movement. All that I can do now is to tell you what I regard as the critical vector. If the force along it that is released is great, we may win. If it is small, there is very little hope for us. I suggest that this is the aspect of the situation that you should most carefully watch for developments if you want to see how things are going. Now, it is customary in patriotic and conservative meetings to speak about the enemy. There are, of course, the two general approaches. The first is that which attempts to provide the audience with two-thirds of the piece of the jigsaw puzzle, speaking endlessly about the horrors of Bolshevism and the cunning of Bolsheviks. And what is said is, of course, both frightening and true. That would make the evil begin with Karl Marx and leave people with the mystery how such a wretched degenerate could possibly have influenced the history of the world. That is, of course, a very favorite approach. When the little hirelings of the liberal press and radio try to ridicule us, they say that we expect to find a communist under every bed. They'd be quite right to laugh at us if we did anything so ridiculous. The space under the beds these days is all occupied by staunch conservatives and patriots who are afraid to look out and see who is in the room. There are, of course, more thorough and more advanced treatments of the problem, but they again concentrate our attention on the phenomenal cunning and satanic evil of our enemies. I agree that they must be almost infinitely evil and wicked in terms of the morality of Western man. But I cannot avoid the reflection that while rabbits undoubtedly believe that wolves are extremely wicked, wolves do not share that opinion. There is, of course, a certain comfort in blaming the enemy for all our losses and all our defeats, but that cannot be the whole story. It takes only one side to start a war, but it takes two sides to make a victory for one. Although I certainly applaud and endorse every effort to expose and denounce our enemies, I think that we foredoom ourselves to failure if we do not once in a while undertake the more embarrassing and painful task of determining what weaknesses in ourselves made their success possible. If, as we say, they have constantly deluded and deceived us, we are no doubt entitled to speak harshly of them and even to curse them. But we'd better also be ashamed of ourselves that we were so easily and so frequently and so constantly deluded and deceived. We men of the West are a peculiar people, basically unlike all other races in our instincts, our predilections, and our mode of thinking. And we shall have to study ourselves very carefully if we intend to survive on this overcrowded planet. One of our most remarkable and disastrous peculiarities, a weakness found to that extent in no other race, is our willful and perverse disregard of even the most obvious facts about the great and unalterable differences between races. It is, I fear, an inveterate failing of ours. If you wish to study a fairly early and very good example of its consequences, consider what happened to the Aryans who invaded and conquered India, only to disappear and be absorbed in a vast and fantastically prolific mass of mongrels. An entirely different approach, but yet a very interesting contribution to our thinking on that subject, in a connection that is less well known, would be a consideration of the Greek world. And for that, I would recommend a critical, very critical reading of the recent book by Michael Astur, Hellenosemitica, published in Leiden 2 years ago. Now, our delusions on the subject of race spring partly from a curious will to believe that others are like ourselves, and partly from a superficial and unthinking observation of other peoples. For one thing, we seem invariably to succumb to the flattery of imitation. The capacity for imitating behavior is common not only to all human beings, but to all anthropoids, as we know from the proverbial expression, monkey see, monkey do. An ape's capacity to imitate is limited, of course, by its inability to speak, but within that limit it is fairly good. Some years ago I saw, and perhaps you did also, a chimpanzee who gave on the stage recognizable imitations of the characteristic movements and gestures of some comedians that were then well known in the cinema. Among human beings, the capacity for imitation is lowest among the australoids, who are the lowest existing form of human life. We possess it to a considerable degree. The capacity for imitation and deceit is found in the highest degree among the two most talented Oriental peoples, the Jews and the Japanese, whose abilities in such matters far surpass our own. But all races can imitate us well enough to deceive careless observers. If they dress in our clothes, observe our social conventions, and speak our language, using the phrases and cliches which, as they can learn from observation, please us, the members of any other race can imitate us so plausibly that we imagine that they have been converted to our mentality and to our conception of life. And any shortcomings that we may notice in the performance, we generously overlook or regard as endearing naivete. The capacity for imitation possessed by at least the more intelligent savages has deceived us time after time. The British are as gullible as we are, and hundreds of times they gave scholarships to Congoloids from Basutoland or Kenya or Nigeria or one of their other possessions, and the result was generally the same. With the money and tutoring given him, the savage bought a good wardrobe, attended an English school, learned to play soccer, went to Oxford and wrote a charming essay on Wordsworth or on Gresham's Law, copulated with half-witted English females who thought themselves intellectual because they were as undiscriminating as the very lowest class of prostitutes. And then, when the savage got tired of living on English generosity and carrying on the pretense, he went home. And, if he thought himself safely beyond the reach of his imperialistic oppressors, he had a well-roasted baby served up to him as a delicacy, of which he had long been deprived by the stupid prejudices of the bigoted British. But what most effectively clouded our minds was a misconception long inherent in our religion. For centuries we have labored under the strange delusion that Western Christianity was something that could be exported. And only recent events have at last made it obvious how vain and futile were the labors and zeal of our devoted missionaries. When Cortes and his small but valiant band of iron men conquered the teeming empire of the Aztecs, he was immediately followed by a train of earnest missionaries, chiefly Franciscans, who began to preach the gospel to the natives and soon sent home, with innocent enthusiasm, glowing accounts of the conversions they had effected. You can feel their sincerity and their joy in the pages of Father Sahagun, Father Torquemada, and many others. For their sake, I am glad that the poor Franciscans never suspected how small a part they had played in the religious conversions that gave them such joy. Far, far more effective than their sermons and their book had been the Spanish cannon that breached and shattered the Aztec defenses, and the ruthless Spanish soldiers who slew the Aztec priests at their own altars and toppled the Aztec idols from the sacrificial pyramids. The Aztecs, Toltecs, and others accepted Christianity not because their hearts were touched by alien and incomprehensible doctrines of love and mercy, but because it was the religion of the white man whose bronze cannon and mail-clad warriors were invincible. That was early in the 16th century, and we of the West have gone on repeating that fond mistake ever since. As missionaries whom we sent to all parts of the world wrote home with innocent satisfaction, glowing accounts of the number of hearts that they had won for Christ. And it was only after the international conspiracies campaign of anti-colonialism really got underway that most of us realized that what had won all those hearts was primarily the discipline of British regiments and the manifest power of the white man. On ashore in Africa, for example, missionaries eager to win souls ventured to land alone. And the natives, after torturing them to death for a good laugh, ate them, cooked or raw, according to the local cuisine. Usually, a few weeks or a few months later, a British cruiser hove to offshore, lobbed half a dozen 4.5 shells into the native village, and if not pressed for time, perhaps landed half a company of Marines to beat the bushes and drag out a dozen or so savages to hang on convenient trees. Consequently, the tribe, if not very obtuse, took the hint and respected the next bevy of missionaries as somehow representing the god of thunder and lightning. And if the men of God distributed enough free rice and medical care with their sermons, they were able to make converts. They could teach a ritual and perhaps inculcate a superstition that had some superficial resemblance to their religion. But as for teaching the spiritual substance of Christianity, they might as well have followed the example of St. Francis and delivered sermons to the birds. Although it is true that in some places in the former colonial possessions, missionaries are still tolerated if they pay well, we have at last learned that the gospel follows the British regiments in the white man's ignominious and insane retreat from the world that was his. Our prolonged misunderstanding has been magnified by another possibly fatal weakness of ours, our strange toleration of the do-gooder, and our incredible obtuseness in never asking against whom he is doing good. For it is unfortunately true that fully 80% of all those high-sounding projects of uplift and social justice are motivated not by concern for the supposed beneficiaries, but by greed or malice. But we never ask. That, incidentally, is why we have so many intellectuals battening upon us. They have discovered the safest and most profitable of all rackets. An intellectual, in the modern sense of the word, is distinguished by two talents: a glib proficiency with words and very sensitive nostrils. He can smell a $20 bill in your pocket a block away. And within 2 minutes after that delicious aroma has reached his nostrils, the ideals are drooling down his jaw. You all know the jargon: the underprivileged, equality of opportunity, the culturally deprived, underdeveloped nations, emerging people, brotherhood, and the like. Ad infinitum nauseam. Now, as you listen to his sing-song, the chances are you won't even notice his hand as it goes into your pocket. Now, we may be rich enough to be suckers,
But what we cannot afford are the more elaborate kinds of do-gooding that are inspired by malice and hatred. But yet we tolerate them with a masochism that is simply suicidal. We have accepted an incredible inversion of values to the point that we have declared ourselves to be an inferior species, fit only to be enslaved, beaten, and butchered at the whim of our masters. That is what the proposition amounts to, although, of course, it is daubed over with the viscid slobber of humanitarian drivel devised by our enemies and mindlessly multiplied by our own sniveling sentimentalists and masochists. But it is not a particularly new thing. If I had time, I would direct your attention in some detail to a vast and irreparable calamity brought on the United States in the last century by a tiny group of vociferous and crazed fanatics, the abolitionists, who forced upon the South its tragic war for independence. I am not, of course, defending slavery as an institution. I believe that Jefferson and Lincoln were right in regarding it as an institution that was pernicious for quite rational reasons, of which the first was that it maintained on our soil millions of persons of a race radically different from our own and by our standards hopelessly inferior. And second, that it resulted in the production of mongrels, pitiable creatures torn apart by the incompatible instincts they had inherited. As you know, it was the firm purpose of Abraham Lincoln to have all the Negroes either returned to Africa or perhaps, in the interest of economy, exported to Central America. But the abolitionists were not rational. They were, I am sorry to say, most of them Americans, including such persons as Wendell Phillips, Professor Elizur Wright, and of course hysterical females, such as Lydia Child and Harriet Beecher Stowe. Their leader was William Lloyd Garrison, who was an American too, although he was financed by Isaac Knapp and other Jews. They were a tiny group, despised by sane Americans north and south, but they ranted and raved until they got their way. They began to agitate in 1840, for dissolution of the American Union and its division by secession into two countries. And after 20 years of ranting, they induced the states of the South to take their proposal seriously. It is most instructive to read the abolitionists. They spout quotations from the Bible, and they babble about human rights and equality, but they do not completely conceal their real aims, the real animus and inspiration. Their venom is directed against the plantation owners of the South, most of whom were ladies and gentlemen. The abolitionists had in their minds a picture, partly correct, of the Southern landowner as a man superior to themselves in education, culture, and humanity. And for that, they hated him implacably. They also had in their feverish minds a picture, totally false, of the planter as a man of unbounded wealth and leisure, who spent his life lolling on a wide veranda and sipping mint juleps, and they envied him passionately. They had a picture equally false of the Southern lady as one who spent her days in fairy-like ease, waited on hand and foot by obsequious slaves. And they also had a picture, largely correct, of Southern ladies as the objects of a chivalrous respect by men that was seldom accorded in the North. And so they yearned to humiliate and destroy the ladies of the South. That was the real inspiration of their frantic and frenetic do-gooding. You can take the measure of what has happened to our national mentality by just remembering the name of that distinguished horse thief and homicidal maniac, John Brown, who, financed by a conspiratorial group that called themselves the Secret Six, was sent into the South to start a slave revolt. Everyone knows and admits that his purpose was to get all the white women of the South raped and butchered. and to get all the white men of the South barbarously mutilated and butchered. But what does that make of him in contemporary opinion? Why, he was a champion of human rights, a martyr of freedom, and all that. He wanted to butcher, yes, but he wanted to butcher white men and women. That is to say, white swine like ourselves, as we wallow in ecstasies of self-abasement and self-hatred. That suffices to make him admirable, to make him noble. And so, we are told, his soul goes marching on, over the red-hot coals, I hope. And I remind you that that little body of howling dervishes brought on us a terribly fratricidal war, inflicting on us an irreparable loss, and impoverishing our nation and our race forever by destroying the genetic heritage of our best men. It also coarsened us morally, perhaps irreparably. After the assassination of Lincoln, which they certainly contrived, our hate-crazed do-gooders had their way. If there is any American who can read the history of all the suffering wantonly inflicted on the white people of the South during what was called Reconstruction, can read that record without hanging his head in shame and feeling through his whole being an anguished remorse, I can only say that he is hard-hearted and sadistic beyond my understanding. With that beginning, is it any wonder that we have reached the point at which now frenzied hatred of us is the certain way of attaining our reverence, our veneration, and our subsidies? How we Americans have been taught to hate ourselves. Chinese communists attack and capture one of our naval vessels, which we, doubtless by agreement between them and our masters in Washington, refuse to defend, although we have ample warning of the attack. Our own men, serving where we sent them, under our flag, and wearing our uniform, are dragged into a degrading captivity of torture. But who cares? They're just white swine like us, born to work and die for their master's pleasure. Now, of course, if they had been something really choice and noble, such as a lousy, mongrel, syphilitic, homosexual, communist cannibal, all of our liberal punks would be out screeching and howling in the streets from dawn to dusk and then all night. Every day, more and more of our young men are shipped to Vietnam and forced to fight under conditions carefully contrived to ensure the maximum loss of American lives and eventual defeat. But let us overlook that. Let us assume that it really is a war and that it is being honestly fought. What is its professed purpose? To secure a naval or air base for the United States? To help and protect our blood brothers in Australia? Those would be rational purposes. Although, of course, one could debate the strategic necessity of that particular location as against another. But no, the ostensible purpose, the declared purpose, is to save the prolific Orientals of South Vietnam from communism. Now, never mind that that purpose is transparent hypocrisy, so transparent that those who utter it sneer at us every time they mouth it. Assume that the purpose is sincere. What then? We are white men of the West, and if we were sane, no truth would be more obvious and unquestionable to us than the fact that all the teeming population of Vietnam is not worth the life of one American soldier. But if anyone suggests that, we're horrified. Are we not the world's slaves to be used for do-gooding? Who cares about our sons? They're expendable. Now, at the instigation of the very contrivers and promoters of that slaughter in Vietnam, hordes of young punks and trollops come streaming from the doors of those abattoirs, which for some reason are still called colleges, and they protest the awful war in Vietnam. What are they protesting? the useless death of a brother, of a former classmate, a white man? No, they're yowling and yammering because some of the sweet Orientals in North Vietnam are getting hurt. If we could only find some plausible way of killing American boys without discomfort to the Orientals, those rabid protesters in our streets would be perfectly happy and content. In Rhodesia, probably the select representatives of our race are maintaining themselves against great odds. What is the attitude in this country? We must slaughter them. They're white men. Butcher them. Kill them. Rape the white women. Kill the white men. And then we will have brotherhood. And you can hear that in many a pulpit, and you can hear that in every classroom. Sometimes from little parrots who are mouthing the equivalent of Polly wants a cracker. Of course, in this case, it's John wants a raise. And sometimes by people who understand what they're saying, and as you watch them, you will see their eyes glow with anticipation and see them lick their dry lips as they look forward to the time when the last white man in Rhodesia is butchered, probably by our own troops in the service of our enemies. Down in Memphis, an agent of our Central Intelligence Agency shoots the black automobile thief, noted communist agent, and bloodthirsty inciter of riots and revolution against us. What happens? Half the white nitwits in the United States snivel and sob and mourn, saying tearfully, "Oh, he wanted to kill white swine like us. Wasn't he noble? Wasn't he saintly? Wasn't he just like Jesus?" One could go on for hours listing more examples, but I have said enough surely to show you what is really the greatest single obstacle that we face, the perverted masochism that has been incited in so many of our own people. That, then, is the point that I would make today. If you Canadians wish at any time to estimate what is likely to happen in the race war in the United States, the important and crucial factor for you to watch is the extent to which we at last learn some of the basic facts about races, and the extent to which we recover from our morbid and psychotic masochism. I admit that our plight has its funny aspect. Dr. Teufelsdruck, up in a tree and meowing for help, is probably not half as funny from one aspect as those poor whites in the United States who wring their hands about our racial problem and have big studies to find out what the racial problem is and just don't know what to do about it. But that absurdity has its tragic aspects, which you should consider very earnestly for your own sakes, for you cannot escape the effects of what happens to us south of your border. We men of the West have many weaknesses, but with the race war now upon us and its coming horrors looming before our very eyes, our crucial flaw is that insane masochism, the imbecility that holds white men in motionless stupor, just as the imbecility of the passenger pigeons kept them roosting on the branches of trees while one of the early settlers climbed up and clubbed them by the hundreds into barrels on the ground below. If we have yet the rationality to overcome our morbid masochism, we have a chance to survive. If we have not, then we shall go the way of the passenger pigeon. The law of nature is harsh and immutable, and in our estimation, cruel. We may weep about it, but nature never has and never will tolerate the survival of weaklings. If we have become a race of befuddled and sentimental nincompoops, then, despite our cherished culture, our incomparable science, our irresistible technology, our beautiful art, and our profound learning, we shall go under and perish from the earth. And if we go under, then despite all that we cherish and revere, and despite the morality that is the peculiarity of our race and seems so high and noble to us, if we go under, I say, we shall have been weighed in the only balance that counts in this world, and we shall have been found wanting. We shall have been proven an inferior species that, biologically speaking, had no right to survive. And when we are gone, no man in after time will mourn our passing. Like the Sybarites, who were in their day a people of superior culture until they became too advanced to defend themselves, we shall be remembered, if at all, with mockery and derision. And we shall have richly deserved the contempt of our successors. For it is we, not our enemies, who will have been the architects of our ruin and the executioners of ourselves and of our children and of all the posterity that we might have had.